Welcome to the Next Wave Radio Hour from WERU Community Radio, a program featuring folks around their 20s and 30s from across Maine. I'm your host, Cecilia O'Hanion, and I use she, her pronouns. In this show, I hope to provide you with unique perspectives of life from the next generation working to create the future they hope to see. My first guest today is the Executive Director of the Hancock County Planning Commission.
Hi, my name is Avery Varney. I am the Executive Director of the Hancock County Planning Commission. I am from Turner, Maine, which is it's near the Lewiston-Auburn area. I actually came to Down East, Maine for the job. The Planning Commission. I went to school at the University of Southern Maine, and then at my end of my school career, I decided to apply for this job. They obviously decided to hire me.
And what did you study in college?
Economics and political science.
Oh, so that's very different than Planning Commission things.
There's a lot of people in planning that come from all different backgrounds.
Really?
There's definitely people who go to school and get degrees in planning. That's a huge part of people in the field, but especially a lot of the planners that I work with in the Maine, backgrounds in anthropology and economics and all of these different areas. And they end up coming to, I've got a friend that her degree is in neuroscience, and they end up coming into this field.
And so when you say field of like planning, if there's a definition for what the field of planning is, like what is that?
Planning takes all forms, but planning, I really think about planning as a way for communities to make informed decisions about where they're going. So there's lots of different types of planning. There's land use planning, transportation, economic development, environmental planning. They're all interconnected in different ways. But a lot of my day-to-day job is just answering questions for different municipalities and helping them work through different issues related to their ordinances or, hey, we've got this, our community isn't very walkable. How can we make it more walkable? Where can we find funding for this specific issue? That's a lot of what I'm dealing with right now. And then long range, what's called a comprehensive plan. State required, there's about 15 different topic areas that cover everything from population, housing, economy, public facilities, physical capacity, transportation.
And that's all Planning Commission.
So municipalities are not required, but encouraged to do these comprehensive plans. So it's a municipal level plan.
Oh, I see.
And it covers all these different topics. And you have your vision of where your community wants to go, your inventory and analysis of where are all your current conditions in your community, and then your goals, objectives, strategies, policies, whatever you want to call them about how you get to your vision.
So within Hancock County, there's multiple municipal.
There's about 39.
There's 30. And so within each
37,
of those.
37, sorry.
Within each of those 37, they each have to have their comprehensive.
They don't have to. They're encouraged to. A lot of them do and are actually developing comprehensive plans or updating them for the first time in, 20, 30 years. But it's not required to have a comprehensive plan. If you have, land use ordinances that are above and beyond what state minimums are, you're supposed to have a comprehensive plan. But it's not required by the state to have one.
So sort of going back in the timeline a little bit. So you graduated college.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that gap from college to Hancock County Planning Commission?
All right. So I worked for a private consulting firm. My professor, Rachel Bouvier, she's a professor of economics at the University of Southern Maine, hired me on to her consulting firm while I was still in college. And I worked on a lot of really, really fascinating projects with her. I worked on a sea level rise vulnerability study for a 6-town region in New York County. We were a consultant on that project. I worked on a couple comprehensive plans, worked on a study assessing the impacts of climate and COVID migration on the Blue Hill Peninsula, actually. Worked a study for, establishing a nutrient credit trading program in the Long Island Sound. So a couple of really interesting programs, and I actually got exposed to a couple land use planners.
Do you take interest in environmental sustainability? Sustainability, is that the right word?
Yes, sustainability. So Rachel, actually, I took two classes with her, environmental economics. I mean, I took more than that, and then natural resource economics. So that's really my interest area and what got me really interested in economics and community development economics. But and that's really what she focuses on is, you think about how you value a wetland. It's more than just looking at the dollar value. One of the things, services that you get, is wetlands help mitigate flooding. And things like that. So it's
and there's value
about,
to that.
Yeah, there's value. So it's putting value on things that don't always have just like the monetary like exchanging of you can sell it for this amount. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the natural resources, environmental mm-hmm. resources.
So you worked with this professor
for about 2 years.
For 2 years.
Yeah.
And then after that?
I came and I moved to Ellsworth. I was actually, when I took this job, I moved into the Planning Commission office at the time because I could not find housing. I bounced around a little bit until I finally just like 2 months ago signed my first year-long lease.
Was there any pressure with you attending higher education, or was it your own decision to go down that path?
It was certainly my own decision. I think that there was encouragement. I come from a very hardworking and supportive family. And so my mom is very much a follow your dreams kind of person. And my dad is very much a follow your dreams, but you know, make sure you can support yourself type of person, which I think is a very good balance. So I don't think there was any pressure. It was really just an encouragement of to do what you want to do, find your own success. And so they supported me in going to college, but I wouldn't say there was any pressure.
What aspects of being a person in your 20s in Maine is hard, difficult, or good? If you want to break it down that simply.
I mean, there are a lot of, I think one thing that's good is there's a lot of, I would say there's a lot of opportunity in Maine. I think that's part of the reason I'm in that position, because Maine is an aging state. And so there's a lot of open positions right now. So I would definitely put that in the good box. And also just, I mean, it's a beautiful place to be. I love Maine. It's been so fun working in Down East Maine on the coast of Maine and getting to explore. Some of the things that are more hard or difficult, I mean, I will say, you know, it's an aging state, as I said, so sometimes it's hard to find friends your age. I will also say that we're in a lot of community meetings, and then just, you know, I think this just comes with the territory of being young, but I get a lot of this whole attitude of young people don't want to work. I hear that a lot, especially in the context of housing, and it's always interesting and sometimes a little frustrating to me, because I am surrounded by young people that are so dedicated to their work and love their jobs and love their communities, you know, working nonstop. So it is challenging sometimes when I hear these comments in rooms, and oftentimes I'm sitting there and I'm hearing these comments, and I'm sitting there in a room with a bunch of like young people that are working at 8 p.m. on like a Thursday.
There's almost like a disconnect there.
I think so. And I think it's just a generational thing. I think every generation tells the younger generation they don't want to work. And then I think also the other aspect of it is because there aren't enough of us, like aren't enough young people in Maine, people are really struggling to fill positions. And so I think there's this attitude of, oh, just people don't want to work, when really the reality is all the young people I know have jobs, have like very taxing jobs, mm-hmm. and there's just not enough of us to fill those positions.
That's what I was about to say. It also sounds like the issue is that there's not enough young people here.
And there's this real like housing crisis. As mm-hmm. I said, like I've moved multiple times, and it was stressful when we were trying to hire from one of our planning positions. I'd bring someone in from out of state because, you know, we're just so worried that he wouldn't be able to find housing. It's not just me dealing with this. There are tons of other professionals that I know that are just in these temporary housing situations, and even with salaries that professionals have, cannot find housing.
Does any of your work involve addressing housing?
Absolutely. So, well, I mean, one, we did get a grant from the Department of Economic and Community Development, their Housing Opportunity Program, for a number of different housing-related projects, but the biggest one is doing a housing needs assessment. How bad is this issue, you know, and all the impacts of it, and then we often, there's a housing chapter in all these comprehensive plans that we're doing. So we get down to the municipal level of what the housing issues are. And then for each of these plans, we develop, you know, goal objectives for that goal, and then strategies for addressing housing. And it's a very difficult issue to address on the local level, but, you know, looking at regional solutions, and there's a couple of cool grants that we've submitted that have some interesting housing projects attached to them that we're waiting to hear back, but it's absolutely an area our work touches on.
How do you prioritize a community's like individual needs, and that the fact that they are all different?
It's always at like the front of our work, and it's interesting because a lot of my experience with the community since I've been at the Planning Commission is through these comprehensive plans, which is an interesting introduction, and there are some state requirements attached to them, and so we have to balance what the state requires for these comprehensive plans with what the communities actually want to see. And solutions to, you know, housing issues are going to be local. They're going to be regional and local issues. And so, and a community knows itself best. So I think really focusing on, and, you know, when we work with these communities, making sure that they're hearing, you know, it's not just the set group of people that you're hearing from. They're collecting input and feedback from the broader community, and they're workshopping ideas. You know, you encourage people to throw things out on the table. You talk about what that, you know, we really come in and, you know, I'm not coming in, none of my staff comes in with like, this is how you need to do this. We come in with, you know, this is how like this community did it and this community did it and this community did it. And, you know, we see, you know, this conditions of, oh, you're a town with, you know, you're a tiny town with less than 500 people and you're coastal or you're not coastal. Here are some other examples of communities with similar conditions and how they've tackled this issue.
There's a lot too that goes into this. So those comprehensive plans, as time consuming as they sound, they're probably pretty kind of helpful.
Yeah.
At like, the end.
It can, it's, I mean, they can be a huge burden to town, and they are a huge burden to town, but one of the, to towns, but one of the things that I found with comprehensive plans is, especially for towns that haven't done them in decades. I mean, we've got one that we're working on that they haven't done a plan. Their last one was 2 pages in like the 1970s. And it's a time for a community to get to know themselves and like refresh themselves and like some like to kind of zoom out and see this broader picture. And then one of the things that I also find going into this is communities are very concerned that things are going to be very controversial, and they can be. But I've actually found it to be a time where, you know, people see eye to eye more than they think they're going to.
When you say controversial, what do you mean?
Well, one of the things the comprehensive plan touches on quite a bit is land use and how you know the impacts of development. And when you think about development, one of the ways that you control development is through regulations. And so there's always this balance of, okay, we have these concerns about development, we want to keep our town rural, what do we do to control it? And we don't want to do, you know, we don't want to implement any more land use regulations,
or like you don't want to bring in a tourist attraction as the thing.
Yeah, tourism is also, or short-term rentals are also another controversial issue. And a lot of it, what I see in Down East Maine, is like a balance of private property rights of, we don't want to tell someone else what to do with their land. And I mean, it's definitely a very valid concern. And so that's something that we go into communities, almost every single one of our communities, it's one of the first thing that they mention is, we're concerned about doing a comprehensive plan because we know this is going to come up and we don't want to tell other people what they can do with their property.
Interesting. So there's almost like seeing that comprehensive plan as there's regulations that come directly tied to it.
Yeah. Which, to be clear, there isn't. There's no regulations that come directly from a comprehensive plan. Anything that would come from a comprehensive plan has to be voted on in a town meeting or another form of government if you're, you know, a city council or something. Mm-hmm. But there's no regulations directly attached to a comprehensive plan.
How do you remind community members that their voice is being prioritized?
Oh, it's absolutely. I mean, the first thing is listening and validating. I mean, because a lot of these concerns are incredibly valid, and people have been doing the same thing for a long time, and in a lot of places it's been working. And I think that's changing with some of the development that we're seeing in Down East Maine, and people are struggling to figure out how to navigate that. But a lot of times it's just about coming in, listening, and then talking about what a comprehensive plan is and what you can do with it and what it does and doesn't mean. You know, a comprehensive plan obviously is about land use, but there are other things that can be used to accomplish your goals that aren't just land use regulations. Like, one of the requirements of a comprehensive plan is, you know, a significant portion of your municipal related, like growth related capital investments go into what is called growth areas. This might be a lot to get into. Okay, how's this? Is thinking about where you invest in what area you invest in your municipality. So thinking about, you know, if you've got public water and sewer, which a lot of areas in Down East Maine, a lot of communities we work with don't, but if you do, thinking about where you want growth and thinking about where you might be able to extend, you know, your public water and sewer, and thinking about that's where you encourage growth, or thinking about where you want to discourage growth. It's not, you know, we have a lot of really good land trusts. We've got some land trust employees that are on the HCPC executive board, which is really, really helpful. But there's also, you know, land trust that can help with conserving land that is, you know, an important natural resource or an important recreational area in a community.
Oh, land trust, such as the Blue Hill Heritage Trust?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The Blue Hill Heritage Trust is actually, their executive director is on our executive board. He actually was just elected to be the chair of our executive board. So we've got pretty strong ties to our local land trusts.
This is the Next Wave Radio Hour from WERU, and I'm Cecilia Ohanian. You're hearing my conversation with Avery Varney, the executive director of the Hancock County Planning Commission. we could answer the very deep question of what does Maine mean to you?
Okay, what does Maine mean to me? People from Maine work hard. They are very connected to where they're from. They have pride in where they're from. They're connected to all of what's around them, and they care about their communities. I am so incredibly lucky to have the support system that I do around me, because, and I think that's just, you know, the connectedness to community that is in Maine. I mean, the mentors that I have in this job that just want to see me succeed and are so focused on the mission of HCPC because it's helping communities in Maine, it's inspiring. And I think, you know, one of the things that is really cool about this job is I get to see, like, one, communities in Maine, like, the communities that I work with are tiny, and they are most of the time run by volunteers or people that get very small stipends. And I think sometimes people don't even realize that their municipality is just run by these dedicated people who are giving themselves and, like, their free time to trying to keep this municipality running. Even if, you know, a town does have a town manager, most of the time that town manager is filling multiple roles. Like, I don't, you know, during these floods, like these winter storms, I knew a lot of town managers that were out there in their knee-high, you know, muck boots. Like,
oh, so it's beyond just, like, administrative management, yes, but physical labor of maintaining.
Oh, yeah. It's
the
everything.
Place in which they live. Wow.
Maine government, like, small town government in Maine is you have people that are doing tons of different jobs.
Wow.
There is a lack of, I think, one, a lack of recognition, and then just a huge lack of capacity, a lack of funding. You know, these comprehensive plans that I'm doing, like, these are often run by, like, they have a volunteer comprehensive plan committee, and there are these chairs that sometimes I'm on the phone with, like, 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night trying to troubleshoot an issue with their comprehensive plan. But a lot of the committees, like, committee chairs that I work with,
they're just members of the community
who care. Yeah. They care about where they're from. They care about the community that they're living in, and they see the importance of investing that time. These communities could not run without the volunteer time and investment and the community feeling. Mm-hmm. If people weren't invested in the communities, these municipalities would not be able to function.
For people who are interested in the kind of work that you do, is there any advice that you would recommend to get into it?
Reach out. I mean, if you're interested in this type of work, like I said, like, the community and planning that I found is incredible. I mean, I have other executive directors of other regional planning organizations that have given me hours of their time because they saw that I had an interest in the work. Cold call someone. I always encourage people my age and younger to cold call people. It's scary, but just know that people in the planning profession want to pass down the knowledge that they have. And also, there's so much opportunity. There's so many jobs open for planners right now. Don't be afraid of not having a planning degree. Also, you reach out to your local municipality, and that's, you know, planning is working with municipal governments. So reach out to your local municipality and see if they need anything. They probably have a committee that they need people for.
You're listening to Next Wave Radio from WERU, and I'm Cecilia Ohanian.
I mean, I could talk about some of the common issues that I'm seeing municipalities face. I think the biggest one is just, like, you know, the overarching is capacity and funding. I mean, it's huge across the state, and I see it all the time in Hancock County. You get aging municipal officials, and things are changing very rapidly, and it's hard to keep up. And so I think capacity is a huge one. And then, you know, as I mentioned, like, the housing is a huge issue in a lot of communities. You know, flooding and these storms that we saw this past winter are a huge, I mean, they're just wrecking a lot of these municipalities. Like, it's pretty heartbreaking to see. And so that's a huge issue. And it ties into the capacity issue, but there's quite a bit of funding out there right now. And it's a kind of a big lift for a lot of communities to apply for all these funding.
Is it on behalf of the municipality to apply for the funding themselves?
It depends. It's very specific. A lot of them can, you know, are municipal specific. You know, we can be the nonprofit that are like the, we can be the fiscal agent for some of these. So we'll apply. We know we've got one that we just applied for and received a grant for a, you know, vulnerability assessment for the Sullivan and Sorrento area.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends. Yeah. So that's a huge solid waste. I mean, the cost of, like, solid waste disposal has just skyrocketed, and there's not really a lot of recycling in this area because it's so exorbitantly expensive. And then, you know, hazardous waste. So, you know, where does your paint go? All of this, you know, the Planning Commission for a long time ran a yearly hazardous waste collection event, and we have not had, because of the struggles that we've gone through, have not been able to hold this event. And we're just looking at this issue of, you know, this yearly event is so much staff time invested, and it's just such a short-term solution. So solid waste and the cost of solid waste are a huge issue that we're noticing. And then, I mean, there's transportation is also a topic that we touch on. Through these comprehensive plans, there's a lot of interest and need for making communities more walkable and safe to bike on. I mean, biking in Maine is scary.
Could you talk a little bit about your time with the Hancock County Planning Commission?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started with the Planning Commission in August of 2022. When I started at HCPC, had had a rough couple of years. And when I'd started, there had been no staff for about 6 months. So we had, at the time, there was Jim Fisher, who he's the town manager of Deer Isle, and he's the outgoing executive board chair at HCPC. He also had been worked at HCPC for about 17 years and is, you know, a planner through and through. And between his work, and then we had two contract planners, you know, a contract bookkeeper and some other dedicated board members that were really trying to keep what would, the bulk of our work was comprehensive plans. We had 8 comprehensive plans when I came on, which is a lot for any organization.
You had 8 you needed to complete.
Yes. Yep.
Wow.
Yes.
And you completed them.
Most of them. Yes.
Incredible.
I have, you know, in the last 2 years, I think we've had about 15 that are in various stages.
Wow.
So yeah, that was what was keeping HCPC afloat. And as I said, I really struggled to find housing for the first part, but my first day at HCPC, I did not see anyone. The first several months of my job, I didn't really see much people unless I was out in community meetings, but I had the previous executive director that came by and sat with me for a few hours, and then Jim came and sat with me for a few hours.
Because I was about to ask, how did you know what to do?
Frankly, I didn't. I was fairly overwhelmed. I was in an organization that I was the only staff member, and I was fairly new to planning. And so I was just sitting there in the office on my own, and I just wasn't sure where to go. So I just dug in, and I spent, you know, my first several months on a few things, but one of them was just reading. I mean, I am very lucky that HCPC has decades and decades worth of files and books. And so I spent a lot of my first couple months just reading everything I could get my hands on. I was taking things off laptops and hard drives and putting them all into a drive, Google Drive, and organizing them. And as I was organizing them, I was reading everything I could. So that was a lot of my, training on the job. And then the other thing that I did that I'm so grateful that I did is I started reaching out. And there is a really great network of planners and regional planning organizations. We're all at this point very well connected. Talk about other young people in Maine.
Are a lot of other people in the same position as you, young people?
Yes. Yeah. Wow. Oh, yeah. There's been a lot of transition, I think, in the planning profession. And so we all have contracts through one state agency. I won't go total alphabet soup, but it's Municipal Planning Assistance Program. And through that, we have quarterly meetings, and twice a year or once a year, they're in person. And so through that network, I get to meet a lot of other planners, and we spend a lot of time just like, you know, bouncing around ideas, like learning about each other's organizations, just trying to figure out how to tackle these different issues.
Yeah.
And then I pretty early on reached out to 2 other executive directors in similar positions who, like I said, took the time to really sit down and spend hours and hours talking with me.
Wow.
So building up that, there is not an issue or a problem that I have that I don't have people that I can call about. And that's one of the things I love about Maine is that, you know, that connectedness and people that are willing to mentor you. So that was one of the things I focused on when I first started, was like building that network with the general planning community and then with the community.
Because I was going to ask, like, do you work one-on-one with the people?
It really depends on the project. I attend a lot of community and committee meetings, a lot of committee meetings. We go to select board meetings, comprehensive plan committee meetings, planning board meetings. So what do I do with municipality? It really depends on the project and what they ask us for. A lot of times they want us to come in and explain, you know, specific state regulations or how to tackle specific issues with their ordinances, like, you know, like solar. We're having this issue with like large solar developments. Like, what do we do here? Or, you know, there's these new laws about housing. Like, what can be in our municipal ordinances? How do we tackle this? Or, okay, we're doing a comprehensive plan. It's time to talk about, like, let's get into the housing chapter, or we get a plan, this public engagement event. I am very grateful. So we now have went from just myself to, we've now got 3 full-time staff members, including myself, an Island fellow who's with us 2 years full-time, 35 hours a week. And then we had an AmeriCorps member who is now coming on with us, you know, doing part-time administrative and GIS or mapping work. So we've gone from this very small team, just myself, to branching out to having quite the staff. It's amazing to see, you know, our capacity grow in this way. And it's also just amazing, like, the team around me, I mean, they all love to learn. And that's the thing about planning. You have to have a love for learning.
So what's upcoming for the Planning Commission?
Cool. All right. You know, as I mentioned, we've grown a lot recently, and we've really been rebuilding and focusing on getting ourselves together administratively, like internal functions, and then expanding our capacity. There's so many communities that are doing comprehensive planning, and so we're really trying to get through it. Just like Hancock County is leading in comprehensive plans right now, but it's a lot of work. So getting through all of these comprehensive plans, and then, you know, we've got our workshops that we do. We try to do them monthly. So, and then we've got a monthly newsletter, which we're very proud of. It's got tons of different training. You know, really, I consider the Planning Commission to be, you know, connecting people with resources. So mm-hmm. our newsletter is really about, like, not just the work that we're doing, but pulling in, like, here's this training that this organization is doing and this organization is doing, and here are all these grants that you can apply for, and here's this cool accomplishment from these other communities. So we do that monthly. And then we've done a ton of grant writing, and we'll continue to do grant writing for all things, but really focused on resiliency, like, you know, climate mm-hmm. resiliency. We've got a housing needs assessment that the goal is for that to be done in the next year, and then updating municipal ordinances for some new housing regulations. Focusing on trying to revive our solid waste program, we've got a new environmental planner that's been really a focus of hers. It's a huge need in the county. And then we are still waiting to hear back, but there is the potential for us to have a regional code enforcement officer position through our office, and several other regional planning organizations are looking at running the same program. So that's exciting. And then really, there is a lot of focus on planning at the state level. And so HCPC and other regional planning organizations have been very involved in these conversations and will continue to do so. So
that was Avery Varney, Executive Director of the Hancock County Planning Commission. You're listening to Next Wave Radio from WERU, and I'm Cecilia Ohanian. My next guest is the multimedia storyteller for the Island Institute. He is also the photo editor and staff photographer of the Island Journal.
Jack Sullivan. I'm a photographer, videographer, writer, a Mainer.
Where are you originally from?
I grew up in southern Maine, so the town of Scarborough. I've lived in Maine my whole life. I don't think I've ever left the state for more than maybe a month at a time. I grew up in southern Maine, and then I went to school in Orono, where I studied new media with a focus in documentary film. I was actually being interviewed for the current position that I have now while I was still in school. And so it was a very quick transition. I moved down to Midcoast, Maine, in 2017.
I also have a background in basically film, video, media as well. So when did your interest in that begin?
Ooh, this is an interesting story. So my media origin story comes in... it comes from my love of Legos.
Okay.
So ever since I was really little, I loved playing with Legos. And one day in middle school, I was playing around with my mother's digital camera, which is nothing like the digital cameras that you see today, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm fooling around with it, and I think that I invent stop motion film because I'm taking photos and I'm moving my little Lego guys around.
And how old are you at this?
I must have been 12. And so I started making all these little movies with my Lego people and posting them to YouTube. Mm-hmm. I eventually fell in love with filmmaking through my Lego collection. Then I moved on to high school and started to use my friends as a talent, getting them to act.
Was it ever difficult to convince them?
No.
No?
Not even a little bit. they loved it. Them. Yeah, that was what we did for fun in the summers, was make silly little movies. And after a very brief stint in business school, I don't know why I went to business school. I transferred immediately, got right into filmmaking, mm-hmm. and took a lot of documentary courses, both in documentary photography and documentary film, up at the University of Maine in Orono. Fell in love with it and just kept trying to make a career out of it.
What is it that drew you to documentary filmmaking or photography?
So telling real life stories became a passion. It was also the best classes were taught in documentary, just so happened. One of my classes was based all around the Camden International Film Festival, and I attended that, I think, 3 times throughout my college career.
Oh, wow.
And so that really fostered my love for documentary film. I work for a nonprofit that is based in Rockland. It's called Island Institute. I am their multimedia storyteller, which means that I am the in-house media generator. I take photos. I write stories for our publications. I do a whole lot of marketing work. So if you go on our website or our social media, a lot of the work that you're seeing is stuff that I produced. It's a lot of short form video storytelling, a lot of sitting down with people who live and work on the coast and interviewing them and learning about their stories and telling them.
That's incredible. And I can see how your documentary filmmaking studies in college helped you with what you're doing right now, because that's what you're doing. You're doing nonfiction storytelling. So do you, when you say up and down the coast, do you go, do you travel with this job?
I travel anywhere from Kittery to Eastport.
Okay.
Yes. So I spend a lot of time driving. I've spent a lot of time on ferry boats. A lot of time, we own a boat. The Island Institute owns a boat, and I'm, you know, just motoring around the coast. I don't get to operate the boat. I have colleagues who do that, but I'm usually, you know, on the stern taking photos. Everything's very, I guess, environmental, right? Like, I have a very rudimentary kit. It's really just me and my 2 mirrorless, well, one of them's mirrorless, one of them's a DSLR, 2 lav mics, my field recorder. It's very, like, I spent, and a tripod, of course. It all has to fit in a backpack, you know, on the go.
And so you just take that whole kit with you and go off and find stories?
Yeah, you know, a lot of it's through our programmatic work, right? We are a climate and economic resilience community development nonprofit. So we spend a lot of time with community members finding out how we can help their communities become more resilient in the face of climate change. Anything ranging from helping a town committee figure out what town infrastructure is vulnerable to sea level rise, to helping lobstermen diversify their livelihoods and get into aquaculture.
So there's research involved in this, is what it sounds
like. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So we're a big nonprofit. I guess everything is relative. There are about 60 of us. And so I work with people who have connections everywhere. And so a lot of this is telling the story of the impact that our organization has had on these communities. You know, I see. So a lot of it is already set up. Some of it, however, because we publish a magazine and a newspaper that I contribute to. Some of it is me finding stories, you know, just using my connections and telling interesting, doing like profiles on interesting community members.
Yeah.
And some of it is historical, some of it is scientific based.
You're listening to Next Wave Radio from WERU, and I'm Cecilia Ohanian. I wanted to ask you about what aspects of being a person in your 20s in Maine is hard or difficult or good. We can go through that one by one.
Oh, man. Well, it's the oldest state in the nation, right? So it is interesting living in rural Maine in your 20s. I just did it. I've got 6 months left of being in my 20s. There are some good things and there are some bad things. One of the cool things is that you're a novelty. In the professional world, people sometimes will turn to you and they want to hear what you have to say because they are concerned about the future and they want to know what you think. Working in the climate change space, it's extremely pertinent. People do want to hear from young folks because we are the ones who are going to end up, you know, suffering the impacts of climate change. You know,
we got
decades ahead of us where we're gonna have to deal with all these mistakes that were made that we had nothing to do with. So people do care about what young people have to say in Maine. Okay, some of the challenges: finding your people is difficult, especially if you just moved here, right? Yeah. I was raised about 2 hours from where I chose to live as an adult. And so that meant that all my networks, all my social networks were just too far away. And so I had to find new friends, which was pretty dang hard as a 20-something in Maine. Another really, really challenging thing is the cost of living, the cost of housing. The housing costs in Maine have gone up, I believe, more than almost anywhere else in the country.
Wow.
In the last few years, Maine is one of the like, people have this misconception that Maine is rural, so therefore it's cheap to live here. Not true. The cost of living has increased to a point that is far beyond the increase of salaries that we've seen in the last few years. So it's tough. It's really tough to make ends meet.
Considering the challenges that you have explained of living in Maine, what keeps you here?
Are you kidding? It's Maine, man. It's like the greatest place on earth as far as I know. I haven't seen much of the planet, but it can't be that much better than Maine.
Wow.
It's clean. It's beautiful. The people are just like some of the kindest folks ever. People are progressive. People are concerned about the future. These communities that I get to spend a lot of time working with, these folks are so dedicated to the longevity of their towns. You know, so I work for Island Institute, right? I spend a lot of time on islands. A lot of these places are absolutely tiny. You know, these towns are sometimes 30 people, right? And they're just these extremely, you know, tight-knit, dedicated to keeping their communities thriving. And I don't think you see that everywhere. And especially just how inviting and welcoming they are. You know, every time I visit the city, I just can't wait to get back to Maine where people actually care about each other.
I'm from Northern Virginia in a very suburb and very urban area. And coming here to Maine, no matter how long I've spent here, how many combined summers equal years, it's always a culture shock in the sense of people here. And I think the importance and value of community that you were explaining, I do not see that where I come from back home.
But basically all I've ever known is this very community-minded culture, and I wouldn't trade that for the world. Also, the fact that I'm a photographer and I do a lot of landscape work, are you kidding? It's like a photographer's playground. It's beautiful. And I get to spend time on lobster boats, and, you know, that's just, it's so much fun to document, so much fun to see Mainers at work in this just absolutely stellar, natural resource-based environment. Like, how much cooler and gritty does it get than, like, pulling things out of the sea and making a living for it?
Yeah.
It's kind of... I guess it's kind of a trope, but it is. It's romantic, and it's also inspiring, and I love just telling that story both visually and in written and documentary format.
What's the most rewarding aspect of your work?
You are a documentary filmmaker. How nice is it when you get to click play after you spend so many hours with all this footage, and it works?
The best feeling in the entire world. It's amazing. It feels really good.
It does. And like getting back and, you know, unloading your memory card filled with photos and video, and just things are in focus. The colors are great. That's incredibly rewarding when you actually get to just create a beautiful product.
When you say creating a beautiful product, that's something that's, I'm assuming, has taken years or just a lot of time or experience to try to perfect. If that's now the most rewarding aspect of your work, when that was a struggle, like when you first started this, because you've said you've been doing this for 7 years, yeah.
Oh yeah, man, I used to be not quite as good as I am. I mean, seeing an improvement in my own work is rewarding.
Because I feel like I'm sort of at the beginning point of developing certain skills when it comes to photography and videography, and I do feel a bit of insecurity with that sometimes, because I'm like, oh, I should have been doing this sooner, or I should already know how to do these things. And so like hearing you say like a rewarding aspect is the fact that I get to create such beautiful things. I'm like, yeah, what do you do when in the beginning you're not creating such beautiful things?
That's a good question, because I have failed. I mean, that's part of becoming a better artist, right? Is just repeated failures. You go back and you look at a shoot that you did and you realize, oh man, I should have been standing 5 feet to the right, or like, I can't believe that I missed that shot. How did I not see that? And then you go back into the field the next time, and you have that in the back of your head, and then you realize, and you get to pat yourself on the back when you know that you did better this time.
Yeah.
And
you can physically see that in your work when you compare if it's photos or videos, one next to each other, and you are 5 feet away where you were supposed to be, or whatever. Exactly. It is.
You got the framing right.
Yes.
That's extremely rewarding. There's also a lot more to my work that's rewarding in a different way. Like recently, I spent about 3 years working on a story that just got published in June, and it was all about a very influential family on a Maine island. And that story took years because it was about building relationships, getting these people comfortable with me telling their story, and then hearing back from them after it gets published, and that they're thrilled with how it came out. You know, like, oh, I got to tell somebody's story, and they were pleased with the results, and they were proud of it, and it felt very collaborative.
You're listening to Next Wave Radio from WERU, and I'm Cecilia Ohanian. Working on something that required you to build connections with people, how did you do that? How did you start from like stage one and then get to the point where it's been 3 years?
It really helps having an association with a brand like Island Institute. So that gets my foot in the door with a lot of subjects. Some of the storytelling that I do is around people who our organization has directly helped. And I think a really good example of that is the repeated storms that we had throughout the winter that did a ton of damage to the coast of Maine. Well, Island Institute, being a responsive community development organization, got things in motion right after the storm and started delivering grants to working waterfront communities, lobster co-ops, and fishing businesses to help rebuild. And so I was in charge of telling the story of that impact, right? So I come in quite literally with my Island Institute hat, with a camera and audio recorder, and I sit these people down and I'm like, okay, tell me your story. I want to know about what happened, and I want to know about how Island Institute supported you. I want to tell this story. Being associated with a nonprofit that has been supporting the coast for 41 years is, a foot in the door to a lot of these communities.
I am assuming there could be hesitancy from communities letting in an unfamiliar media outlet or whoever it may be into their community to tell their stories. Has you ever noticed any hesitancy from communities with you coming in, either on behalf of yourself or the Island Institute?
Yes.
Please speak on that.
There are two different types of people, right? There are people who love the camera and people who fear the camera, or hate the camera. So sometimes it doesn't matter. If you're holding a camera and you're walking into a working waterfront, certain people are going to view you as their enemy no matter what. I've been cursed. I've been threatened. And I politely back off. Other people, it doesn't matter if I'm shooting for Island Institute or if I'm just shooting on my own, other people see a camera and say, hop aboard my boat.
Like, really?
Please take all these glamour shots of me.
And do you do it?
Yeah.
I have been saying this whole summer, I need to find someone with a boat. And I just found someone who knows how to get on boats. This is, okay, good to know. It's very nice to meet you.
Well, I feel like I got to talk about my WERU origin story.
Yes, now. Please. Yeah.
So when I am not photographing or writing stories or making documentaries about the coast of Maine, I have other nonprofits that I commit a lot of time and energy and love to. I have two other nonprofits that my heart belongs to. One of them is Watts Hall Community Players. I'm an amateur actor. We recently just put on a production of Spamalot, which is a musical adaptation of Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Oh, super cool. So support local theater.
Love Shout local out. Theater.
Yeah.
I got to be the guy with the coconuts. I was Patsy, King Arthur's trusty servant. So much fun. And then the other nonprofit that I love is WERU 89.9 FM out of Blue Hill, Maine. This is DJ Jack Fonches, and you are not currently listening to my regular radio show that I do. I am a radio DJ at WERU. I am also a member of the board. Good old Matt Murphy approached me one day.
Everything leads back to Matt Murphy.
Everything goes back to Matt.
So much appreciation for him.
What's up, Matt?
So you joined WERU, and the show that you do is?
I do Daydream Nation Saturdays from 6 to 8 p.m. I am every second Saturday of the month. I would come a lot more often than I do, but fortunately I live about an hour and a half away from the radio station. So
this is my assumption for everybody who gets involved in radio is a love for music. Mm-hmm. And was that the case for you? And if so, what genres or music you began with?
I spent a lot of time around musicians. I am not a musician, but a lot of my best friends are. My brother is. I spent a lot of time in college with people who were in bands. I was always the guy who took videos and pictures of the bands and followed them around. Yeah, so like all of my roommates in college were in bands, mm-hmm. and I was their little documentarian. I didn't really pursue that too much afterwards. Sometimes, every now and again, I do a side gig. Sometimes I actually will shoot music recitals. So sometimes I still do take pictures of people playing music. I love where those things intersect, but that hasn't been necessarily a part of my career. But media in general has been a huge part of my identity. And I think that music is a form of storytelling. It's definitely in that same vein. Radio is media, music is media, filmmaking is media, photography is media, print publications are media. Mm-hmm. So I have kind of grown to
love it all, yeah, and be able to exactly. do it all and be amazing at it all.
Drink from the media fire hose, yes. if you will.
Is there any media field that you haven't touched upon yet that you would want to? You may not even know it exists yet.
Right? I've never made my own podcast.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because I was about to ask, have you ever produced anything with the Island Institute that is just audio interview with someone or a story that's told just audibly?
No. We actually do have a contracted podcaster.
Do they need help?
Who knows, maybe. She's very talented. It's called From the Sea Up is the name of our podcast. Her name's Galen. She does a tremendous job. She does a fabulous job.
Very cool.
So
do you see yourself staying in Maine long term?
I do, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't really see myself living anywhere else except maybe Nova Scotia, or maybe I don't really think I don't need to spend my life anywhere else. This is where, you know, many generations of my family have lived in Maine. And it's a great place to raise a family. And I've gone on about how much the communities care about each other. So it's a really great place to be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. I think it's very powerful to hear your connection to just your home and the place you call home and just the people that live here as well. Is there anything you wish you had known before now? Something you could have told yourself 5 or 10 years ago that could have helped you?
I think the best advice that you could give somebody in retrospect is to just keep doing what you're doing and don't worry about making mistakes, because mistakes are how you get to where you're going.
I can appreciate you saying that, because I'm always focused on the making mistakes part and the worry of not making mistakes, not necessarily, you know, what I'm doing and being engaged in that.
Yeah, I think we become who we are by fumbling around, and, you know, when you're in your 20s, that is the time to
fumble around.
Yeah, just screw up.
Yeah.
And hopefully those screw-ups don't destroy your life. None of mine destroyed my life, thank goodness. If you asked me this question and one of those screw-ups did destroy my life, I might say, wait, no. 21-year-old Jack, don't do this. It's kind of like a cheat code. That's, like, not fair to be able to go back in time and tell yourself about the mistakes you're not supposed to make.
So moving forward, what's in the future for you?
I honestly don't know. I love my job.
Amazing.
I don't intend on changing careers anytime soon. Yeah, I don't know. I'm honestly gonna just keep doing what I'm doing for now.
That's incredible. That means you're happy with what you're doing.
Right? Like, at least the next, like, 5 years, you know, you should probably shake things up eventually, because mm-hmm. then I'll just be 80 years old. For the next 5 years, I'm going to keep things pretty steady, but eventually I should probably shake things up a little bit. Otherwise, I'll have spent my life doing the same thing. Good question. I can't even think that far ahead. Yeah. I'm still busy thinking about next week's schedule. About the interviews I need to line up, and about the ferry spots that I need to reserve, and I can't think that far ahead.
That was Jack Sullivan, photographer and multimedia storyteller for the Island Institute. You can check out his storytelling and photography work at brassduckphoto.com. My name is Cecilia O'Hangin, and this has been the Next Wave Radio Hour. I want to give a huge thank you to my guests today, Avery Varney and Jack Sullivan. Thank you also to the Maine Community Foundation for supporting this program. Our theme music is by Zeke Zacharidis. You can find the archive of this and every other episode of Next Wave at weru.org and wherever you get your podcasts. If you would like to get in touch, you can email nextwaveradio@weru.org. Next Wave Radio airs on the fourth Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. And now I'd like to share a little bit about my experience as an intern at WERU this summer. My time with the station began with substitute DJing last summer for a range of shows. When fall came around, I returned back to Northern Virginia, where I go to school at George Mason University. I have my own radio show with my university's radio station, WGMU, so I was very excited to apply all my new WERU knowledge. As a film and video studies major, my time in college has been filled with all sorts of media. So when the internship-seeking season appeared, I immediately thought of my friends at WERU. Together, Matt Murphy, general manager, and I mapped out all sorts of projects and events I could be involved with at the station, and before I knew it, the summer was filled. I began with outreach work, like tabling at the WERU booth and sharing thanks to new members through phone calls. I got to use my background in video and filmmaking to create content for WERU's social media during the Quiet Drive and Membership Drive. Projects like this meant working collaboratively with other amazing WERU staff. My DJ subbing continued on shows like Afternoon Snack and Jumping Tracks, and my on-air time got a helpful boost when I learned to write and record promo scripts. Throughout the months of June, July, and a wee bit of August, I've gotten the chance to attend some amazing events WERU is involved with, such as Juneteenth Down East Celebration, Maine Celtic Celebration, and even a Hot Suppers concert. These events are a true reflection to the range of experiences I gained through this internship, whether that be learning to use audio equipment, MC, or set up a stage for a performance. One of my favorite things I've been a part of with WERU is an audio workshop with Torchlight Studios and the Salt Institute in Belfast. I returned from this workshop with a defined passion for audio, public broadcast, and radio. Truly, I attribute this entire internship towards helping me find so many areas of interest I didn't even know I wanted to pursue. I gained confidence in my technical skills with editing, audio and video, as well as gained new ones, like learning to produce a podcast episode. This episode of Next Wave Radio that you're hearing right now was entirely recorded, edited, and produced by me. Yet another project this summer I'm so grateful to have gotten to work on. This whole experience affirmed my want to pursue nonfiction storytelling, and with the amount of people I met this summer through WERU and at WERU who made me feel so passionate about that, I know it's possible. If you're a young person interested in getting involved on air or behind the scenes, visit WERU.org or email us at info@WERU.org. If you'd like to hear other programs hosted by young people, listen to Relationship Rewind, Afternoon Tracks, Late Night Blend, Jumping Tracks, and Daydream Nation.